to make reference to a few of the texts that I'm sure you've been collecting in the meanwhile and for your own fast. There might be something here that you haven't thought of, at least today, regarding the significance of the fast. You know that the law itself adorns the preamble of the Book of Laws. Baha'u'llah mentions that in one of the prayers for the fast. It's, along with obligatory prayer, those are the first two laws that appear in the Kitab-i Aqdas. And as you know, he's defined heaven, religion as heaven, and the sun and the moon of that heaven are fasting and obligatory prayer. Fasting occupying the station of the sun, which has this power of divine illumination. And he states clearly that he has endowed every hour of these days with a special virtue, and that then he's assigned a portion of that virtue to each soul, and that then it's our duty to seek to become aware and consciously receive, if you will, the virtue of that hour, of each hour of the fast, which should keep us on our toes instead of just thinking about it in the morning and the evening or at lunchtime. We can think about it other times as well. What is the virtue of the fast from 3 to 4 this afternoon, for example? Did you miss it or did you get it? You know. Also, in one of his tablets, Baha'u'llah speaks about observing the fast for the sake of his beauty. Observe for my beauty's sake the fast, O people. That's something we'd like to meditate on, really, during the fast. We talk about the motive for fasting. Oh, it's the law of God. But it should transcend the willingness to obey and submit to the law of God and become the motive for it should become the beauty of the Messenger of God, the beauty of his teachings, the beauty of his revelation that attracts us and motivates us to fast. In the questions and answers, Baha'u'llah states, "Verily I say that God has appointed a great station for fasting and prayer. During good health, its benefit is evident. If when one is ill, it is not permissible to fulfill them." Abdu'l-Bahá, in several tablets and talks, refers to the fast, and in one of them he says, "Fortunate are ye to have obeyed the commandment of God and kept this fast during the holy season. For this material fast is an outer token of the spiritual fast. It is a symbol of self-restraint, the withholding of oneself from all appetites of the self, taking on the characteristics of the spirit, being carried away by the breathings of heaven, and catching fire from the love of God." That passage is in the selections from the writings of Abdu'l-Bahá, page 69. It's a nice one to have to review when you're fasting. In another tablet, and this is published in the Tablets of Abdu'l-Bahá, page 684, he says, "Beside all this," and he's described this similar list of helpful things, he says, "prayer and fasting is the cause of awakening and mindfulness and conducive to protection and preservation from tests." Now, that's always helpful. Very useful. It doesn't mean you're not going to have tests. You're just going to be preserved and protected during them, I think. Some people say, "Well, that means no tests at all." No. We know that tests are sent to the soul to help it develop. But the point is, you don't want to fail the test. And the fasting is a means of assuring that you'll meet the test in the right spirit and derive the benefit and spiritual growth that are conveyed by them. In an article, in an interview really of Abdu'l-Bahá when he was in England that was published in the Fortnightly Review in 1911, he was asked about fasting. He says, "Fasting is a symbol. Fasting signifies abstinence from lust, physical fasting is a symbol of that abstinence and is a reminder. That is, just as a person abstains from physical appetites, he is to abstain from self-appetites and self-desires. But mere abstention from food has no effect on the spirit. It is a mere symbol, a reminder. Otherwise, it is of no importance. Fasting for this purpose does not mean entire abstinence from food. The golden rule as to food is, do not take too much or too little. Moderation is necessary. It's a good thing to remember when we pile up our breakfast food in the morning, you know, to prepare a super meal in the evening to be able to survive, or have lunch at midnight or whatever it is we do, we'll make sure we'll survive. We don't want to, you know, overload the body at the same time that we're fasting. We destroy the whole physical purpose of it anyway. Granted, we need to eat, though. Abdu'l-Bahá goes on to say, a man is not fit to do service for God in brains or body if he's weakened by lack of food. He cannot see clearly. You may identify with this particular sentence about 4 p.m, I don't know. I find I gravitate towards routine types of arranging papers on my desk and doing this. When Karin True was in the Holy Land, speaking with her and her family, the master started talking to them. They had asked about the divine wisdom of fasting, and he gave some very interesting explanations about this. He says, the divine wisdom in fasting is manifold. Among them is this. As during those days, that is the period of fasting which the followers afterwards observed, the manifestation of the Sun of Reality through divine inspiration is engaged in the descent of verses, in the revealing of the divine verses, in other words, the instituting of the divine law and the arrangement of teachings. Through excessive occupation and intense attraction, there remains no condition or time for eating and drinking. For example, when His Holiness Moses went to Sinai and there engaged in instituting the law of God, he fasted 40 days for the purpose of awakening and admonishing the people of Israel. Fasting was enjoined upon them. Likewise, His Holiness Christ, in the beginning of instituting the spiritual law, the systematizing of the teachings and the arrangements of councils, for 40 days abstained from eating and drinking. In the beginning, the disciples and Christians fasted. Later, the assemblages of the chief Christians changed fasting into Lenten observances. Likewise, the Quran, having descended in the month of Ramadan, fasting during that month became a duty. In like manner, His Holiness the Supreme One, the Bab, in the beginning of the manifestation, through the excessive effect of descending verses, passed days in which his nourishment was reduced to tea only. Likewise, the Blessed Beauty, when busy with instituting the divine teachings and during the days when the verses of the Word of God descended continuously, through the great effect of the verses and the throbbing of the heart, took no food except the least amount. The purpose is this: in order to follow the divine manifestation, and for the purpose of admonition and the commemoration of their state, it became incumbent upon the people to fast during those days. For every sincere soul who has a beloved longs to experience that state in which his beloved is. If his beloved is in a state of sorrow, he desires sorrow. If in a state of joy, he desires joy. If in a state of rest, he desires rest. If in a state of trouble, he desires trouble. Now, since in this millennial day His Holiness the Supreme One, the Bab, fasted many days, and the Blessed Beauty took but little food or drink, it becomes necessary that the friend should follow that example. For thus saith he in the Tablet of Visitation, they, the believers, have followed that which they were commanded for love of thee. This is one wisdom, of the wisdom of fasting. The second wisdom is this: fasting is the cause of awakening man. The heart becomes tender and the spirituality of man increases. This is produced by the fact that man's thoughts will be confined to the commemoration of God, and through this awakening and stimulation, surely ideal advancements follow. The third wisdom: fasting is of two kinds, material and spiritual. The material fasting is abstaining from food or drink, that is, from the appetites of the body. But spiritual, ideal fasting is this: that man abstain from selfish passions, from negligence, and from satanic animal traits. Therefore, material fasting is a token of the spiritual fasting. That is, and then he gives a prayer: O Divine Providence, as I am abstaining from bodily desires and not occupied with eating and drinking, even so purify and sanctify my heart from the love of anyone save thyself, and shield and protect my soul from corrupt desires and satanic qualities, so that my spirit may commune with the breaths of holiness and fast from the mention of all else besides thee. The article is from Star of the West, and the translation is a revised translation. It's been authorized by the House of Justice several years ago. I don't have copies of this for everyone, but I'll leave this up here, and if someone wants to offer to take the names of those who might like copies, perhaps we could have copies of it. If you don't, those of you who already don't have it in hand. It's the only prayer we have from Abdu'l-Bahá that I know of translated about fasting. Then from the Guardian: as regards fasting, it constitutes, together with the obligatory prayers, the two pillars that sustain the revealed law of God. They act as stimulants to the soul, strengthen, revive, and purify it, and thus ensure its steady development. People ask, well, what is it that develops the soul, or what can I do to grow spiritually? He says these are the main causes of the stimulant and development of the soul: fasting and obligatory prayer. The ordinance of fasting is, as is the case with these three prayers, which is the obligatory prayers in other words, a vital obligation enjoined by Baha'u'llah upon every believer who has attained the age of 15. The fasting period, which lasts 19 days, is essentially a period of meditation and prayer, of spiritual recuperation, during which the believer must strive to make the necessary readjustments in his inner life and to refresh and reinvigorate the spiritual forces latent in his soul. Its significance and purpose are therefore fundamentally spiritual in character. Fasting is symbolic and a reminder of abstinence from selfish and carnal desires. So this is a time to make the necessary readjustments in our inner life and to refresh and reinvigorate the spiritual forces latent in our soul. Nice to know that they're latent there, they're already there. We can be animated by the effects and virtues of the fast. Keeping the fast is enjoined upon all Baha'is, regardless of nationality. It has a very salutary effect, both physically and spiritually, and the friend should realize Baha'u'llah never would have instituted it if it were detrimental to the health. On the other side of that, of course, one should be in good health to keep it. And if you find that it makes you ill, then he says you should refer to a physician for advice and abstain from it. Or if you get ill, that is, that would be, I should think, more in the line of chronic illness, whether it's good for you overall to fast, but also if you fall ill or become ill during the day of the fast, then you should consider, if, depending on the severity of it, consider stopping fast that day and see how you feel. To one believer, he said, likewise, you are quite free to say the beautiful prayers ordained for this period, even if you cannot fast. And they will say, oh, I don't want to lose the bounties of the fast. But when you obey the law of God, which says, abstain from fasting when you're ill, you can still use the prayers, and I think that you can still gain benefits from the fast. And if a woman is pregnant, why should she miss the virtues of the fast? She doesn't do the physical part of the fast, but she can do the part of the prayers, you can think of it. So that's not, in a strict sense, fulfilling the fast, but I think that the benefits, one can turn to God and ask for those benefits. After all, Baha'u'llah says in the prayer for Nowruz that whoever is fasted depends on God's good pleasure, whether that fast is accepted. And he may ordain that those who have fasted haven't fasted, and those who have fasted haven't fasted. So, meanwhile, if you're feeling well, there's really no excuse for not fasting. But he doesn't have any need of us giving up food. I mean, it really doesn't do anything for God at all, as far as I can figure out. The whole benefit is for us. And so we wanted to make something more than just the physical absence from it. Jesus, without going into all of the other ins and outs of the fast, you are aware that if you eat or drink accidentally, that is, you forget, or you're walking down the hall and the drinking fountain's there, you have a drink and then you stand up and remember that you're fasting, the guardian says this is not to be considered breaking the fast if you accidentally break it. If you say to yourself, I'll just have a short drink, that's of course something else. Do you have any questions, if you want to comment, you want to make about fasting, so you could ask for the question. Have you come? Theme of the sovereignty of the Qayyim. On page 106, Baha'u'llah repeats one of the questions of the Bab's uncle. Why is it that the sovereignty of the Qayyim, affirmed in the text of the recorded traditions and handed down by the shining stars of the Muhammadan dispensation, which is a reference to the Imams, hath not in the least been made manifest? Nay, the contrary hath come to pass. Have not his disciples and companions been afflicted of men? Are they not still the victims of the fierce opposition of their enemies? Are they not today leading the life of abased and impotent mortals? Yea, the sovereignty attributed to the Qayyim and spoken of in the scriptures is a reality, the truth of which none can doubt. This sovereignty, however, is not the sovereignty which the minds of men have falsely imagined. Moreover, the prophets of old, each and every one, whenever announcing to the people of their day the advent of the coming revelation, have invariably and specifically referred to that sovereignty with which the promised manifestation must needs be invested. This is attested by the records of the scriptures of the past. This sovereignty hath not been solely and exclusively attributed to the Qayyim. Nay, rather, the attribute of sovereignty and all other names and attributes of God have been and will ever be vouchsafed unto all the manifestations of God, before and after him, inasmuch as these manifestations, as it hath already been explained, are the embodiments of the attributes of God, the invisible, and the revealers of the divine mysteries. On page 108, in the second line, begins the section that Shoghi Effendi has extracted for the gleanings. And the gleanings is section 13, and it runs over to the middle of the next page. I'm going to read that for you, or maybe. Is Anishu here tonight? No. Okay. Even as the sovereignty of Muhammad, the messenger of God, is today apparent and manifest amongst the people, you are well aware of what befell his faith in the early days of his dispensation.
What woeful sufferings did the hand of the infidel and erring, the divines of that age and their associates, inflict upon that spiritual essence, that most pure and holy being? How abundant the thorns and briars which they have strewn over his path! It is evident that that wretched generation, in their wicked and satanic fancy, regarded every injury to that immortal being as a means to the attainment of an abiding felicity, inasmuch as the recognized divines of that age, such as Abdullah ibn Ubay, Abu Amir, Amir the Hermit, Ab ibn Ashraf, and Nasr ibn Harith, all treated him as an impostor and pronounced him a lunatic and a calumniator. Such sore accusations they brought against him that in recounting them, God forbiddeth the ink to flow, our pen to move, or the page to bear them. These malicious imputations provoked the people to arise and torment him. And how fierce that torment if the divines of the age be its chief instigators, if they denounce him to their followers, cast him out from their midst, and declare him a miscreant. Hath not the same befallen this servant and been witnessed by all? For this reason did Muhammad cry out, No prophet of God hath suffered such harm as I have suffered. And in the Quran are recorded all the calumnies and reproaches uttered against him, as well as all the afflictions which he suffered. Refer ye thereunto, that haply ye may be informed of that which hath befallen his revelation. So grievous was his plight, that for a time all ceased to hold intercourse with him and his companions. Whoever associated with him fell a victim to the relentless cruelty of his enemies. Continuing on page 110, consider how great is the change today. Behold, how many are the sovereigns who bow the knee before his name. Here's Muhammad. How numerous the nations and kingdoms who have sought the shelter of his shadow, who bear allegiance to his faith and pride themselves therein. From the pulpit top, there ascendeth today the words of praise which in utter lowliness glorify his blessed name. And from the heights of minarets there resoundeth the call that summoneth the concourse of his people to adore him, even as those kings of the earth who have refused to embrace his faith and to put off the garment of unbelief, nonetheless confess and acknowledge the greatness and overpowering majesty of that day star of loving kindness. Such is his earthly sovereignty, the evidence of which thou dost on every side behold. This sovereignty must needs be revealed and established either in the lifetime of every manifestation of God or after his ascension unto his true habitation in the realms above. Examine the notes for this pages. The history of each of these heralds that's mentioned, the names were mentioned in that passage that we read, Abdullah, Ubay, and so on. There's a lot of things that are fascinating about them. I'll just read you something about the first one. He was, of course, one of the opponents of Muhammad. He was a pagan divine who was the chief of the hypocrites. The Muslim commentators relate that he was a tall man of very graceful presence and of a ready and eloquent tongue, and he used to frequent the Prophet's assembly, attended by several like himself. He was said to have kept 6 slave girls for prostitution. One of them complained to Muhammad, and in response, the Quranic verse 24:33 was revealed. He promised help to the Jewish Bani Hazir if they stayed in Medina and fought the Prophet. following their violation of the covenant that they had made with him, that the Jewish community had made with Muhammad. He drew off 300 men from battle by predicting their certain death in the expedition of Tabur. In his last illness, he died in the 9th year of the Hijra. His son came and asked Muhammad to beg pardon of God for his father, which the Prophet did. Abdullah Ubay then asked to see him and to be buried in his shirt. Each one of them has an interesting history. That was one of the worst opponents, and he had this reversed in the last hours of his life. On page 111, in the following paragraph, it says, "The following is an evidence of the sovereignty exercised by Muhammad, the day star of truth. Hast thou not heard how with one single verse he hath sundered light from darkness, the righteous from the ungodly, and the believing from the infidel? All the signs and illusions concerning the day of judgment which thou hast heard, such as the raising of the dead, the day of reckoning, the last judgment, and others have been made manifest through the revelation of that verse. These revealed words were a blessing to the righteous, who on hearing them exclaimed, O God our Lord, we have heard and obeyed. They were a curse to the people of iniquity, who on hearing them affirmed, we have heard and rebelled." Now, the different commentators, Persian commentators on this verse, on what is this single verse, have said, having derived from the Persian, where it is not so clearly one single verse, but a verse, first of all, they say the verse is not identified, but it's presumed that it may be any one of the verses that causes the believers to respond or not respond. I found that a little weak. There's nothing in the writings to say which verse this is. Then I found recently, looking through some of the provisional translations of the writings of the Bab, that he mentions about how God caused these things to happen through the voice of the manifestation when he says, "Am I not your Lord?" And I think we can understand from this the intention of this single verse, although we don't know what exactly it is. Also, we could consider verse 7:18 in the Quran, which says, "Verily, I am the messenger of God unto you all," uttered by Muhammad, and think of the results that would be produced by that, if you affirm the truth of it or if you deny it. No? Acceptance or denial of this one verse would suffice to establish a position in relation to God. And as he says here, through this single verse, he has sundered light from darkness, the righteous from the ungodly. Now, he talks about this being a well-known verse. Further over to on 113, he says also, "Consider how this one verse, which hath descended from the heaven of the will of God, the world and all that is therein has been brought to a reckoning with him." In one of these passages, he calls it a well-known verse too. In any case, we get the drift of it. I think that's just what's intended there. While explaining this, further on page 112, Baha'u'llah also refers to the Satan of self. Observe how those in whose midst the Satan of self had for years sown the seeds of malice and hate became so fused and blended through their allegiance to this wondrous and transcendent revelation that it seemed as if they had sprung from the same loins. Such is the binding force of the Word of God, which uniteth the hearts of them that have renounced all else but Him. who have believed in his signs, and forth from the hand of glory, the co-sire of God's holy grace. Are you familiar with the question of the interpretation of the devil or Satan in the Baha'i writings? For instance, Abdu'l-Bahá says when he was asked, what is Satan? He said, the insistent self. In the Baha'i teaching, Satan is not viewed as an independent force, but rather as the natural inclinations of man's lower nature, his animal nature. This lower nature is symbolized as Satan, the ego inclined to evil, which is a part of each human soul. It is not an outside personality. And then we have this quote from Abdu'l-Bahá. God has never created an evil spirit. All such ideas and nomenclature are symbols expressing the mere human or earthly nature of man. It is an essential condition of the soil of earth that thorns, weeds, and fruitless trees may grow from it. Relatively speaking, this is evil. It is simply the lower state and baser product of nature. And that's found in the Promulgation of Universal Peace. You may find it at page 289, depending on which edition of the book you have. If it's not on 289 in your edition, you might have to look around nearby. It could be nearby, about 10 pages one way or the other. Back briefly to the outline now, if you want to cover some of this material in a very brief way. Part two of the outline, where he's speaking about why the sovereignty of the Qayyim is not manifest. On page 113, you have the significance of the wolf and the lamb shall feed together. That's explained there. On 115, I think. On 14, in the middle of the page, he speaks about the life of faith, the heavenly and everlasting life. He says, by the terms life and death spoken of in the scriptures is intended the life of faith and the death of unbelief. The generality of the people, owing to their failure to grasp the meaning of these words, rejected and despised the person of the manifestation, deprived themselves of the light of his divine guidance, and refused to follow the example of that immortal beauty. At the bottom of page 115, we have the quote, and there was a blast on the trumpet. Lo, it is the threatened day, and every soul is summoned to a reckoning with him, an impeller and a witness. The bottom of page 116, nay, by trumpet is meant the trumpet call of Muhammad's revelation, which was sounded in the heart of the universe, and by resurrection is meant his own rise to proclaim the cause of God. We have some examples then of spiritual rebirth coming up here. Page 118, the verse of Christ, you must be born again. Except a man be born of water and of the Spirit, he cannot enter into the kingdom of God. That which is born of the flesh is flesh, and that which is born of the Spirit is spirit. He explains the purport of these words is that whosoever in every dispensation is born of the Spirit and is quickened by the breath of the manifestation of holiness, he verily is of those who have attained unto life and resurrection and have entered into the paradise of the love of God. And whosoever is not of them is condemned to death and deprivation, to the fire of unbelief, and to the wrath of God. In all the scriptures, the books and chronicles, the sentence of death, of fire, of blindness, of want of understanding and hearing has been pronounced against those whose lips have tasted not the ethereal cup of true knowledge, and whose hearts have not been deprived, and whose hearts have been deprived of the grace of the Holy Spirit in their day. Even as it hath been previously recorded, hearts have they with which they understand not. And then he cites this example of one of the disciples. Says, and it came to pass that on a certain day the father of one of the disciples of Jesus had died. That disciple, reporting the death of his father unto Jesus, asked for leave to go and bury him. Whereupon Jesus, that essence of detachment, answered and said, let the dead bury their dead. There's also the example of Ali the commander, about a dead man's house. On page 120, in every age and century, the purpose of the prophets of God and their chosen ones has been no other but to affirm the spiritual significance of the terms life, resurrection, and judgment. It also goes on then to explain, interpret the earlier phrase from Ali. Coming over to the meaning of spiritual sovereignty being superior to worldly sovereignty. Page 123, to resume, our purpose in setting forth these truths has been to demonstrate the sovereignty of him who is the King of Kings. Be fair, is this sovereignty, which through the utterance of one word hath manifested such pervading influence, ascendancy, and awful majesty, is this sovereignty superior, or is the worldly dominion of these kings of the earth, who despite their solicitude for their subjects and their help of the poor, are assured only of an outward and fleeting allegiance, while in the hearts of men they inspire neither affection nor respect? Hath not that sovereignty, through the potency of one word, subdued, quickened, and revitalized the whole world? What can the lowly dust compare with him who is the Lord of Lords? What tongue dare utter the immensity of difference that lieth between them? Further down on the page, this is but one of the meanings of the spiritual sovereignty which we have set forth in accordance with the capacity and receptiveness of the people. For he, the mover of all beings, that glorified countenance, is the source of such potencies as neither this wronged one can reveal nor this unworthy people comprehend. Immensely exalted is he above men's praise of his sovereignty. Glorified is he beyond that which they attribute unto him. And again on the top of 125. Were sovereignty to mean earthly sovereignty and worldly dominion, were to imply the subjection and external allegiance of all the peoples and kindreds of the earth, whereby his loved ones should be exalted and made to live in peace, and his enemies be abased and tormented, such form of sovereignty would not be true of God himself, the source of all dominion, whose majesty and power all things testify. For dost thou not witness how the generality of mankind is under the sway of his enemies? Have they not all turned away from the path of his good pleasure? Have they not done that which he hath forbidden and left undone, nay, repudiated and opposed those things which he hath commanded? Have not his friends ever been the victims of the tyranny of his foes? All these things are more obvious than even the splendor of the noontide sun. He goes on to explain other aspects of this. For instance, in the bottom of 127, he says the terms ascendancy, power, and authority imply a totally different station and meaning. For instance, consider the pervading power of those drops of the blood of Hossein which besprinkled the earth. What ascendancy and influence hath the dust itself, the sacredness and potency of that blood exercised over the bodies and souls of men? So much so that he who sought deliverance from his ills was healed by touching the dust of that holy ground. And whosoever wishing to protect his property treasured with absolute faith and understanding a little of that holy earth within his house, safeguarded all his possessions. These are the outward manifestations of its potency, and were we to recount its hidden virtues, they would assuredly say, He verily hath considered the dust to be the Lord of lords, and hath utterly forsaken the faith of God. This must tell us something about the holy remains of the manifestations of God and the influence that they have, proximity to their shrines and so on. Station of sacrifices described here, particularly in relation to Hossein's martyrdom. Many mysteries connected to this. It's a history in itself. Let's see if I have a note on it. On page 128, it makes reference to the circumstances that have attended the martyrdom of Hossein. It's interesting for us to take time and consider that a little. You know, Baha'u'llah, one of the mysteries of the Baha'i faith is that Baha'u'llah claims to be the return of the Imam Hossein, the third Imam of the Shias. And it's mysterious because he's the supreme manifestation of God, and his revelation transcends all the revelations of the past. And yet he identifies himself with the return of one of the successors of the Prophet Muhammad, and chooses to identify his spirit with the spirit evinced by Hossein. Hossein was the son of Ali and the third Imam, as he said. He died in a historic episode of tremendous repercussion on the Shias down through the centuries. He and a band of his family and supporters, numbering 72 according to the traditions, were surrounded by an immense force representing the Umayyad Caliph, Yazid. This host of thousands of men intercepted Hossein near Karbala as he traveled north on his way to asylum in Kufa in the year 680 AD. The Umayyads were demanding his pledge of allegiance in denial of his right of succession as the head of Islam. The fighting appears to have been of a sporadic nature, consisting of a single combat and brief forays. The steady fire maintained by the Umayyad archers on Hossein's camp took its own toll. One by one, Hossein's supporters fell, and then the members of his family, until only he and his half-brother Abbas, the standard-bearer on that day, were left of the fighting men. Abbas was killed trying to obtain water for the thirsty women and children, and the army converged on the lone figure of Hossein. Carrying his infant son in his arms, Hossein pleaded for water for the babe, but an arrow lodged in the baby's throat and killed him. As the troops closed around him, Hossein fought valiantly until at last he was struck a severe blow that caused him to fall face down on the ground. Even then, the soldiers hesitated to deal the final blow to the grandson of the Prophet until Shim ordered them on, and according to some accounts, himself came forward and struck the blow that ended Hossein's life. The Umayyad army looted the tents, decapitated the bodies of all of Hossein's companions, and raised these on spears to lead their procession back to Kufa. The women and children who had been taken prisoner included Ali, the only surviving son of Hossein, not Ali his father, but his son, who had been too ill to participate in the fighting. At Kufa, Ubaydu Allah convened a great assembly and ordered the head of Hossein to be brought to him on a tray, and also the captives. And when the head was placed before him, he struck the lips with his cane and he taunted the captives. Some of those witnessing this scene were intensely moved, and one of them spoke up, saying, Remove your cane from those lips, for by God, many a time have I seen the lips of the Prophet of God on those lips. At a later stage in Baha'u'llah's ministry, after the Iran was revealed, he has dictated a lengthy and detailed tablet of visitation for the Imam Hussein, in which he refers to his martyrdom as the most great calamity and a grievous affliction. Through his martyrdom, the soul of the chaste one, Fatima, was melted, Baha'u'llah says. And the Apostle Muhammad lamented, and the inmates of the Supreme Paradise cried out, and the realities of existence were consumed. He refers to Hussein as the Prince and King of Martyrs, the pride and beloved of martyrs. Through him, the light of detachment shone forth in the world, and the near ones were adorned with the ornament of piety. If it were not for Hussein, the injunction of the B and the E would not have been manifested. The choice wine would not have been unsealed. The bird of divine testimony would not have sung forth. And the tongue of grandeur would not have spoken amongst the followers of diverse beliefs. Bayim Baha'u'llah states, the mystery of true knowledge became manifest in every land, and the light of certitude shone forth from the heaven of testimony. Through him, the doors of divine grace were unlocked to the world. For 9 pages, Baha'u'llah continues to extol the wonders and effects of Hussein and of his great sacrifice. The meaning of riches and poverty on page 132.
That on a certain day, one of the companions of Sadiq, and Sadiq is one of the Imams too, the sixth Imam, complained of his poverty before him, for the Imam. Whereupon Sadiq, that immortal beauty, made reply, "Verily thou art rich and hast drunk the draught of wealth." That poverty-stricken soul was perplexed at the words uttered by that luminous countenance and said, "Where are my riches? I who stand in need of a single coin." Sadiq thereupon observed, "Dost thou not possess our love?" He replied, "Yea, I possess it, O thou Seer of the Prophet of God." And then Sadiq asked him, saying, "Exchangest thou this love for 1,000 dinars? He answered, "Nay, never will I exchange it, though the world and all that is therein be given me." Then Sadiq remarked, "How can he who possesses such a treasure be called poor?" This poverty and these riches, this abasement and glory, this dominion, power, and the like, upon which the eyes and ears of these vain and foolish souls are set, all these things fade into utter nothingness in that court, even as he hath said, "O men, ye are but paupers in need of God, but God is the rich, the self-sufficing." By riches, therefore, is meant independence of all else but God, and by poverty, the lack of things that are of God. Beginning on page 135 with the verse when the unseen, the eternal, the divine essence caused the day star of Muhammad to rise above the horizon of knowledge. Among the cavils which the Jewish divines raised against him was that after Moses no prophet should be sent of God. Yea, mention hath been made in the scriptures of a soul who must needs be made manifest, and who will advance the faith and promote the interests of the people of Moses, so that the law of the Mosaic dispensation may encompass the whole earth. Thus hath the King of Eternal Glory referred in his book to the words uttered by those wanderers in the valley of remoteness,
and error. The hand of God, say the Jews, is chained up. Chained up be their own hands. And for that which they have said, they were accursed. Nay, outstretched are both his hands. The hand of God is above their hands. And he talks about the absurdity of all this whole contention that the revelation is ended at any particular point. And of course, this bears on the question of the seal of the prophets, which the Muslims raise as a contention against the appearance of the Bab and Baha'u'llah. They say, well, Muhammad was the seal of the prophets, so that means that has to be the seal of prophecy, and there can't be any more revelation after him. He talks about how the Jews have raised this protest for over 1,000 years and so on. Then in the middle of page 137, thou art surely aware of their idle contention that all revelation is ended, that the portals of divine mercy are closed, that from the day springs of eternal holiness no sun shall rise again, that the ocean of everlasting bounty is forever stilled, and that out of the tabernacle of ancient glory the messengers of God have ceased to be made manifest. Such is the measure of the understanding of these small-minded, contemptible people. These people have imagined that the flow of God's all-encompassing grace and plenteous mercies, the cessation of which no mind can contemplate, has been halted. From every side they have arisen and girded up the loins of tyranny and exerted the utmost endeavor to quench with the bitter waters of their vain fancy the flame of God's burning bush. Oblivious that the globe of power shall within its own mighty stronghold protect the lamp of God. From here, Baha'u'llah moves on to the theme of attaining the presence of God. He says, the utter destitution into which this people have fallen doth surely suffice them, inasmuch as they have been deprived of the recognition of the essential purpose and the knowledge of the mystery and substance of the cause of God. For the highest and most excelling grace bestowed upon men is the grace of attaining unto the presence of God and of his recognition, which hath been promised unto all people. This, he explains, is the utmost degree of grace vouchsafed unto man by the All-Bountiful, so on. Then he gives some examples of this from the Quran to establish that, for instance, at the bottom of the page, they who bear in mind that they shall attain unto the presence of their Lord and that unto him shall they return. Or again, let them then who hopeth to attain the presence of the Lord work a righteous work. And again, he ordereth all things, he maketh his signs clear, that ye may have firm faith in attaining the presence of your Lord. The people have repudiated all these verses that unmistakably testify to the reality of, quote, attainment under the divine presence. No theme has been more emphatically asserted in the Holy Scriptures. Notwithstanding, they have deprived themselves of this lofty and most exalted rank, this supreme and glorious station. Some have contended that by attainment under the divine presence is meant the revelation of God in the day of resurrection. Should they assert that the revelation of God signifieth, and here Baha'u'llah interprets three degrees of divine revelation. Shoghi Effendi calls them the three stages of divine revelation. Here they could be thought of as three stages, but Shoghi Effendi has defined them in his resume of the Igon as the three stages, which becomes quite significant in understanding, if you will, the science of revelation. Should they assert that the revelation, and here this word is tajali, and this is also corresponds like effulgence, and he identifies this attaining to the presence of God with the attainment to the effulgence or splendors of God that pour out of the manifestation of God. He says, if that effulgence signifieth, and this is the first stage of revelation, a universal revelation, it is clear and evident that such revelation already existeth in all things. The truth of this we have already established. Now, do you remember when we were reading last week, back on page, 105, something like that? 102, from that which hath been said, it becometh evident that all things in their inmost reality testify to the revelation of the names and attributes of God within them. We were talking about this theme, how all things are constituted, if you will, are woven, the fabric of beings is woven with the threads of the names and attributes of God. So there are different patterns, because they're woven of the different names and attributes or energies of the divine reality. That becomes their basic significance or meaning or substance, if you will, spiritual substance. Now here he's saying that this universal revelation is admittedly, if... Hold on a second now. The truth of this we have already established, inasmuch as we have demonstrated that all things are the recipients and revealers of the splendors of that ideal king. We're at the top of page 140. And that the signs of the revelation of that sun, the source of all splendor, exist and are manifest in the mirrors of all beings. Nay, were man to gaze with the eye of divine and spiritual discernment, he will readily recognize that nothing whatsoever can exist without the revelation of the splendor of God, the ideal king. Now think of that in relation to the explanation of Abdu'l-Bahá, that creation is an emanation from God. All creation flows from God and is flowing from God. It didn't flow and stop, it's flowing. This is another reason he says that if you say that the grace of God has been chained up, the hand of God and his bounties have been chained up, then you're also saying that creation stops, because creation is emanating. God is creating creation at every instant. He sustains it instant by instant, if you will. In one place he talks about how you don't see the break, but it's there. I mean, he's constantly doing it. It's not as if creation is separate from him. He's independent of it, but it flows from him. It's like the rays of the sun. If you're going to have a sun, you'll have rays. If you have God, he says, you will have creation, because God implies the master of all. It implies mercy. Mercy implies creatures that are recipients of mercy. It implies sovereignty to be God. That implies the need for creatures and subjects who recognize that sovereignty. Otherwise, where's the reality of it? So he explains it in this sense. Now he says, nay, were man to gaze with the eye of divine and spiritual discernment, he will readily recognize that nothing whatsoever can exist without the revelation of the splendor of God, the ideal king. Consider how all created things eloquently testify to the revelation of that inner light within them. Behold how within all things the portals of the Rizwan of God are opened, that seekers may attain the cities of understanding and wisdom and enter the gardens of knowledge and power. Within every garden they will behold the mystic bride of inner meaning, enshrined within the chambers of utterance in the utmost grace and fullest adornment. Again, we have this theme of the Huris, if you will, of heaven that people have been promised when they go to heaven they will attain to them, as attainment to the significance, the spiritual significance and inner meanings of the divine reality, divine words. Then he cites some verses from the Quran on this theme. He says, neither is there aught which doth not celebrate his praise. And we noted all things and wrote them down. Now he says, if by attainment unto the divine presence or under the presence of God is meant attainment under the knowledge of such revelation, it's evident that all men have already attained under the presence of the unchangeable countenance of that peerless king. Then he raises this question, why then restrict such revelation to the day of resurrection? Because the scriptures say you will attain to the presence of God in the day of resurrection. And they would say the day of resurrection hasn't come yet. But if they interpreted the revelation to be universal revelation, then indeed everybody's attained to it. Not that we're all aware of it, in the sense that we were talking about how the quality of the heart, if life has come to it through the breath of the manifestation of God, if it breathes the life of faith, if its eyes are animated by this power of seeing with his purpose in things, then it begins, the eye then, we're told, begins to observe and see these signs and everything. It begins to read the wonders of the attributes, names and attributes of God in all kinds of created things and in our own experience and in our own activities and in the beauties around us of nature and in the wonders that we see in other souls around us, our fellow believers and everyone else. Now, again he creates the supposition that perhaps they want to say that by divine presence is meant the specific revelation of God. This is another stage. We had universal revelation, now we have specific revelation of God. This has been expressed by certain Sufis as the most holy outpouring. Feyz-i Akdas, if you've got your Persian notes going. If this be in the essence itself, which is the way it's interpreted by many of the Sufis, it's evident that it hath been eternally in the divine knowledge. Assuming the truth of this hypothesis, attainment under the divine presence is in this sense obviously possible to no one, inasmuch as this revelation is confined to the innermost essence unto which no man can attain. The way is barred and all seeking rejected. That, by the way, is the phrase from the Imam Ali. The minds of the favorites of heaven, however high they soar, can never attain this station, how much less the understanding of obscured and limited minds. Now, there is this arising of brilliance, we're told in some tablets of Abdu'l-Bahá, within the essence, which constitutes one of the kinds of love. When he describes the love of God, he describes the love that God has for his own beauty. And this is what's associated with this question of the specific revelation of God, the revealing of the beauty of God to God himself, which prompted him, as he saw his own beauty, to manifest it to creatures. At least there's no time sequence in this, but this is an eternal thing that's going on. His own recognition of his own beauty causes it to share it with creatures that can love him. And he knew the love that he had for the creatures. He created all of us, and all of the creatures of the universe, if you will, all of the beings who are receptive to him, so that they might also attain to this, to the degree possible, to this beauty. But as far as penetrating to that specific revelation of God going on within the Godhead, that's obviously beyond the capacity of any of us to attain. So he goes on and he says, were they to say that by divine presence is meant the secondary revelation of God, interpreted as the holy outpouring, this is, you'll find this in Sufi accounts as the Feyz-i Muqaddas, this is admittedly applicable to the world of creation, that is, in the realm of the primal and original manifestation of God. This is something that happens at the level of the manifestation of God. He receives the secondary revelation of God. Such revelation is confined to his prophets and chosen ones, inasmuch as none mightier than they have come to exist in the world of being. This truth all recognize and bear witness thereto. These prophets and chosen ones of God are the recipients and revealers of all the unchangeable attributes and names of God. They are the mirrors that truly and faithfully reflect the light of God. Whatsoever is applicable to them is in reality applicable to God himself, who is both the visible and the invisible. The knowledge of him who is the origin of all things and attainment unto him are impossible save through knowledge of and attainment unto these luminous beings who proceed from the Sun of Truth. By attaining thereto to the presence of these holy luminaries, the presence of God himself is attained. From their knowledge, the knowledge of God is revealed, and from the light of their countenance, the splendor of the face of God is made manifest. Through the manifold attributes of these essences of detachment, who are both the first and the last, the seen and the hidden, it's made evident that he who is the Son of Truth is the first and the last, the seen and the hidden. Likewise, the other lofty names and exalted attributes of God. Therefore, whosoever and in whatever dispensation hath recognized and attained unto the presence of these glorious, these resplendent and most excellent luminaries, hath verily attained unto the presence of God himself, and entered the city of eternal and immortal life. Attainment under such presence is possible only in the day of resurrection, which is the day of the rise of God Himself through His all-embracing revelation. The day of resurrection, meaning the day that a new manifestation of God arises and promulgates His faith in the world. Attainment to that manifestation is attainment to the presence of God in the day of resurrection. But in the process, Baha'u'llah has also revealed to us these three stages of revelation, three different kinds of revelation. Okay, I think we'll continue our discussion of these themes next week. We'll look then at some of the questions that we have in that section too. Does anybody still need copies of the questions? There's still a few of the pages for converting from the American page numbering to the British page number. Does someone need that? Happy fasting.